even in a pandemic, this city's crime and murder rate is still high. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, how the city plans to expand Cure Violence to bring down those high crime numbers. You can give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, a new restaurant opening in the nation's oldest city, despite pandemic woes, plus some more news and notes. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, the Department of Health reports a one-day increase of nearly 8,200 cases of COVID and an increase overnight of 212 deaths. The death toll in the state now from the virus, 8,765, with 345 deaths reported in Northeast Florida. Amidst these numbers, violent crime continues to be an issue in this city, pandemic or no pandemic. Wednesday, Mayor Curry said that he's working with Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams, State Attorney Melissa Nelson, and local community groups and nonprofits to address the root causes of violent crime. The mayor referenced a shooting which took place over the weekend in Northwest Jacksonville. And he said he's going to expand an innovative program on the ground in this city called Cure Violence to a third neighborhood. This program aims at reducing violence by treating it like a communicable disease, approaching violence as a public health issue. Here's the mayor talking about Cure Violence.
As of today, the Northside Bridges location is reporting one murder related to urban violence, which includes gang activity, in the last 100 days. And earlier this year, the Noah's Ark site saw an 85-day stretch without a murder.
As we talk about this, we want your calls. Joining us right now, longtime police reporter for the Florida Times-Union, Dan Scanlon. He's on the line. Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good morning.
Good to have you. And as we talk about Cure Violence in Jacksonville, give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Dan, as the mayor talks about this, there have been several consecutive nights of violent crime in the last week or so. 340 shootings reported in Jacksonville this year. That's in August. There were 389 shootings for the entire calendar year of 2019 and 114 homicides for this city with 5 months left to go. And so what we're seeing is even in the midst of a global pandemic, when people are staying home more often, not out and about as much, violent crime just continues unabated. It remains a huge issue for this city. What are your thoughts about the mayor and other public safety officials expanding Cure Violence to try to address this?
Well, just to correct you, according to unofficial Times Union records, we've had 116 homicides recorded so far this week.
Oh, my numbers are old. Okay,
year.
Thank you.
And we also had 7 shootings over the weekend, including the one that the mayor was referring to at a park on Richardson Road that included a 15-year-old victim. We also had over the weekend at least one homicide, a man found shot dead in a car on Franklin Street. So those are just the numbers. We also had a stabbing on San Pablo Road, and she died at the scene. Those are just the numbers since Friday. So mm-hmm. That's less than a week. As far as the mayor, obviously, they believe that Cure Violence is working, and he's going to be spending $1.75 million in his recommended budget on that program out of Chicago. It's a one-on-one whose staff deals with families affected by shootings. But when I spoke to Sheriff Mike Williams right after we hit our 100th homicide, he did admit that, yes, community programs are great and they are necessary, but the COVID pandemic has sort of slowed down that face-to-face for obvious reasons.
Right. And so it's really remarkable to see how durable the crime problem is in this city. No matter what is going on in the world and how it's affecting our daily lives, crime continues day in, day out, as you just pointed out. The president of the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville, Ben Frazier, is calling for increased funding to combat gun violence. He's saying a big chunk for the sheriff's office in the city budget's line item should go to other programs. And so what's been the response to these calls? Certainly we've seen a social justice movement around this in recent years as well, the city budget and how it's allocated for public safety. Do you feel that that's getting a serious look, or is Jackson going to stay the course in the way it funds public safety?
Well, the mayor did indicate other community programs and that they were working with other community and nonprofit groups. The sheriff also indicated that they want to see more of that. And in fact, his top statement to me was that the people in the community who take advantage of the crime, there's no doubt there's impact from people getting locked down and getting antsy over the virus. But he also indicated that he desperately wants to get some more community programs going when we spoke. Isaiah Rumlin, who's the head of the NAACP, told me he was very, very upset. And he said elected officials need to take a bold stance and do what's necessary to, quote, invest in these communities in order to get rid of this crime. So that's it. In 32209, which has the highest, traditionally the highest number of homicides in a zip code in the city, the community groups and leaders there have been saying, please bring in programs, train our residents, give them meaningful jobs as alternatives to going out and doing crime.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit more about Cure Violence. Jacksonville is one of a number of cities that is trying this program out. As you said, it began in Chicago, and it changes the paradigm in how we look at this issue and how we approach it. It looks at violence as a public health issue, as a communicable disease. And violence interrupters, as they're called, are placed in neighborhoods to try to de-escalate situations before people resort to gun violence. For people who aren't familiar with how this works, can you talk a little bit about how Cure Violence is developed and deployed in neighborhoods?
All I can tell you is that these violence interrupters go out and talk to victims, try to stem some of the arguments. A lot of what we've had in the past few weeks have been drive-by shootings. You have to think that is a tit-for-tat response. You did this to me, I'm doing this to you. And according to last year's statistics, in zip codes 32206 and 09, city officials say the violence interrupters stopped 37 shootings, likely saving 11 lives. So it appears to be working, or was working, when you could get out there.
When it can work. We don't know yet the details on the third Cure Violence neighborhood, do we, Dan? That has not been made public yet.
No, he is not, and I haven't dug deep enough into the budget, but I would have to guess it might even include some parts of Arlington, where there's been a large number of homicides and shootings over the past few months.
And we'll go to your calls in a moment. What are your concerns about the city's crime rate, gun violence problem, high murder rate? As we speak with Dan Scanlon of the Times Union, it's 549-2937 to join us. Now, you mentioned a minute ago that people are even more anxious than usual in this pandemic. Unemployment is high. People are out of work. We don't have a lot of data yet to show how this is affecting the crime numbers, but common sense, you know, would lead you to conclude that it's not helping.
Well, the sheriff has certainly commented on that. I went out to the 100th homicide. It was in an Arlington neighborhood just before midnight, and it was a brutal shooting. There was actually some video shot of it, which we didn't release because it would have determined who shot it. But you could see this gentleman got obviously involved in some confrontation, and at least two other people gunned him down in a parking lot of an apartment complex. Again, was that a drug deal gone bad? Was that an argument that got settled with guns? Who knows?
Right. For people who've lived here all their lives or for a long time, it's as predictable as the summer heat that we have just an enduring gun violence issue in this city. And we are an outlier in Jacksonville when you look at how this problem manifests in other Florida cities and other cities comparable to us in size. It is the most vexing public health and safety problem that we can just count on in Jacksonville. And, you know, for years you have covered, Dan, efforts to deal with this for decades. And it is it's just unbelievable how durable this problem is and the inability of varying administrations to really make a meaningful impact.
Well, the faith community area ministers have jumped in over the past decade with projects about the, I mean, you've got mad dads out there every Saturday trying to get people to pass tips on to First Coast Crime Stoppers about crime victims. Ben Frazier obviously been very vocal with his Northside community group, trying to get the sheriff's office to speak, trying to get more programs out there to get the stolen guns out of the hands of people. And so far, I can't tell you of any program that has given any indication of success, except for maybe SOS, Save Our Kids, that does still
Save Our Sons, yeah.
Save Our Sons. That's about the only one that still seems to have any track record and has been around for a few years.
Let's go to some calls now. As Cure Violence expands to more neighborhoods in Jacksonville, wherever you are in the community, whatever corner you call home, give us a call, 549-2937. AJ in Arlington. AJ, good morning.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Melissa. This is AJ with Mad Dad.
Hey, how you doing?
Mm-hmm. Fine. We, you know, we still out here trying to do things, and we got programs, but we seem to get ignored. But,
and why do you think that is? I mean, Mad Dads has been around for a while now.
I can't really tell you. I mean, we out weekly. We talk to the community. We somewhat do what Cure the Violence do. We know we try to prevent crime and direct children and parents to other things besides that, but we just seem to get ignored. We've been doing this for 16 years, but we just can't get no traction.
And when you mean traction, I mean, you mean funding, public funding, right?
Funding, yeah, public funding, because, you know, that's just what we need. But my question is, when you say, Dan, that Cure the Violence has stopped 37 shootings, I think you said, and prevented 11 homicides, I think that's what you said. Is that just them putting out numbers, or is this what... How we know that's accurate? How we know that's true?
That is what the city presented as proof in an earlier story that the Times Union did. We have not been really able to get close to this. Obviously, they want to keep it close to the vest. They're talking with crime victims, and they don't want reporters there. But that's their presentation. You
okay.
Know, take a look at the crime numbers, take a look at the shooting numbers, take a look at the homicide numbers.
And you know, AJ, I'm sure Mad Dads has stopped murders and shootings. And if you measure it, I would think if you can demonstrate and quantify how you've done that, that might make a difference in terms of getting some more traction for the model that you are using in neighborhoods.
We, Melissa, Dan, we have met with city officials several times. We have presented our budget and things we need. We just don't get no traction. People call us daily with information that I personally relay to JSO. So we do have a real relationship with the community, our Facebook page, our Instagram page. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of information. We get a lot of, besides JSO, Mad Dads, our Facebook page get a lot of hits. I mean, so I don't know what else Mad Dads can do but continue to do what we always have done is, you know, just go out there and do what we do. But, you know, we stay encouraged, and we're going to be out this weekend with a family, matter of fact.
So what are you going to be doing this weekend?
A young man got shot and killed in his car July 9th, and we're just going to go out and canvass the community and talk to the community and encourage them to come forward.
Okay. AJ, I want to thank you for what you do, and thanks for calling in as well. That's AJ in Arlington. And groups like Mad Dads have been doing the really tough work in communities for many years now, Dan, as we heard him explain, without a lot of public support.
They're going out 11 to 12 on Saturday seeking justice for Anthony Canvas around the Jamie's Road area, and that's the one they're handling with. And then I did a story on the 15-year-old young man who is now paralyzed after a drive-by shooting pierced the front of his house while he was sleeping and hit him. And Mad Dads indicated they might be doing something with that if the family needs that or wants that. So they're out there. I know they're out there every weekend. I've been talking to them and AJ for years now about crimes, but sometimes we just don't find out if anything they did, any tip they got out there, any nudge they made results in an arrest. We just don't find that out.
Until after the fact, or maybe never.
Right.
549-2937, Marie in Southern Oaks. Hi, Marie.
Hi. Yes, I just feel the cost of living skyrocketed.
We're having trouble hearing you, Marie. I'm so sorry.
Okay, can you hear me now?
That's a little better. Go ahead.
Okay, the cost of living is skyrocketed. Wages have stagnated. People have to work 2 and 3 jobs, and they still can't make a living. And they give up in despair and turn to crime. We got to do something about this. It's outrageous what's going on.
Okay, Marie. Yeah. Thank you for that. And poverty and unemployment, Dan, are a factor. There is no doubt about it.
Again, you take a look at the employment numbers or lack thereof in that 32209 area, the community leaders, the city council members, the school board members I've spoken with over the years say they've got to get more jobs in there. There's got to be investment in the community so that there is a reason for someone to find an alternative to seeking street crime, that they actually have a job that they can know that they can earn money at.
Your colleague at the Times Union, the columnist Nate Monroe, has been very critical in many of his columns about what he calls this city's refusal to invest in itself, to make even modest investments in the types of initiatives that would provide more opportunity to underserved communities, even basic infrastructure improvements in poorer communities. Just last week, the city refused to raise the millage rate, the property tax rate, even a tiny tick, to fund some of the programs certain advocates have called for many years. And so there's just no political will in Jacksonville to invest in quality of life initiatives that might make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
Sorry. Yes, and indeed, I can only repeat what every community leader I've spoken with up there says. There just is no investment in the communities like 32209, or not enough to give alternatives out there. And I don't know why the city is not reacting to that. I know the sheriff is. I know, obviously, the Cure Violence program is. I just don't know what the nonprofits are doing. There even used to be churches in some of these areas that were holding job fairs to try to get employment opportunities available to the residents, and I haven't heard of any of that of late.
549-2937, Greg on the south side. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Alyssa. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Great topic this morning. One comment, one question. I, for a long time, I'm a black male, and former law enforcement.
Okay.
For a long time, I've thought that we know the elephant in the room is that a lot of these homicides are being committed by young black men. Now, here in Jacksonville, only all over this country, north, south, east, west, young black men are killing each other. And I think that we need to take a good forensic look at each of these homicides to determine if there is some type of what I think of as a mental health self-hate issue among these young black men. When I was growing up, it wasn't that way, but there are several books out there. It's good to look at prevention and the things that are going on, but I think it's more of a mental and spiritual health issue that's going on in the black community. People often talk about, you know, Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, and I explain it to people like this. They try to say that if Black Lives Matter, why are you killing each other? Well, those are two different things, two different subjects. When it comes to Black Lives Matter and the police, it's a matter of police are supposed to serve and protect. So, but when it comes to black on black crime, I think that it is a more of a we should address it from a mental health issue. So, Mr. Scanlon, in your reporting, have you ever seen of any communities that are addressing that, this issue in that way?
Greg, thanks for that.
Other than programs like SOS, which is trying to hit young men in their preteen and try to work with them early to give them some alternatives, and obviously Big Brother's over the years trying to give a male role model. I don't know. I mean, you talk about
Sanctuary on 8th Street. There are a number of programs, but they tend to work in silos. Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
You talk about age and young. It was a 17-year-old boy who was arrested in the recent shooting death of a 39-year-old woman near Old Kings Road. I mean, the age of the victims, the age of the suspects is usually under 20 of late.
Here's a tweet from a listener as we talk about Cure Violence. I've read they do community-oriented policing, although I want to see evidence of that. And if we don't understand by now that the root causes of crime are poverty and alienation, we will never make a meaningful impact. Jimmy tweets the show, any data to back up the effectiveness of Cure Violence in Jacksonville? Dan, as you said, we do have what the city has released so far.
Right, because that's about all that we have right now is what the city is telling us. Some of our other reporters have been able to get close to some of it, but the city tries to basically keep us away because they're working one-on-one with crime victims, and I understand the reason. Having a reporter hanging out would hamper that effort.
John calling from 32209. Hi, John. Good morning.
How you doing, Miss Melissa?
Okay, go ahead.
I'm not going to take too long, but I want to give and lay down some real facts and some history about Jacksonville, Florida. I'm born and raised here. I'm 47 years old, almost 50 years old, and I grew up in 32209, 08, and 06.
Mm-hmm.
The problem in Jacksonville is that since consolidation, the city council has refused any revitalizing economics on that side of town. Fact number one, the center that is up by the airport, that was done with the Magic Johnson Group. Twice, Magic Johnson and them came to revitalize the Gateway area and put economics in that area. And twice, the city council refused, and they gave them the land up off of Leggett, Max Parkway. They gave them that land to build that economics there. Every time a company comes into Jacksonville, they funnel them to the Mandarin area, the deep J. Turner Butler area, and out Dunn's area. And this is historically done to support the prison, the Scooter Pipeline prison, and the industrial complex. What people don't know about Jacksonville, Jacksonville jail system is one of the biggest money makers in Jacksonville, to the tune of about 60 million to 70 million a year. They make over 60% of Jacksonville is on probation. So number one, what has to be done is stop blocking the economic upliftment of that area. There is no jobs over there.
I got you, John. And you are correct that since the city consolidated, there has been a chronic underinvestment in neighborhoods to the north and the west of the St. John's River. And there's a new social justice committee, Dan, on the Jacksonville City Council pledging to address these historic inequities. The mayor has said he supports it. And so let's close out with your thoughts on how that could potentially have an impact on this long-standing issue for this city.
I think it's a very nice idea. Again, committees are committees, and the proof is in the pudding when something happens. But the fact that we have so many council members recently speaking out about racial inequities along with community leaders gives me some hope. It's just I'm getting tired. We're all getting tired of hearing this. 2020 has not been a good year, and I even got caught by the San Marco train yesterday. So, you know, that's about the icing on the cake. But to be serious, it has been a lousy year, and to have a homicides at this high number is possibly as bad as it can possibly be.
It really is. As always, your insights are much appreciated. Thanks for joining us.
Take care.
Dan Scanlon of the Times Union with us. Much more still ahead. Later, how you can help this area's blood banks today, especially if you're a recovering COVID patient. We'll tell you how later on, but up next.
We're using this occasion just to highlight the lack of economic security that is experienced by Black women in Florida.
Why today is Equal Pay Day for Black women. We'll be right back.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, today, August 13th, is Black Women's Equal Pay Day. It's a symbolic day, meaning that a typical Black woman would have to work until August 13th of this year to make as much money as a typical white man made in 2019. So nationally, Black women make 62 cents for every white man's dollar. In Florida, that figure is 60 cents. AAUW Florida sponsored research on the economic insecurity of working Black women. The local branch contributed to this as well. I learned more from Pat DeWitt, president of AAUW Florida, and Damika Jackson, Chair of Advocacy and Education with the Mayor's Commission on the Status of Women. Take a listen. Pat and Damika, good to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Pat,
thank you.
Pat, let's start with you. When we read through this report, what do we learn about Black women's equal pay day and what the numbers show?
Well, actually, Black Women's Equal Pay Day is August 13th, and that's the day to which a typical Black woman, would have to work to make as much money as a white man made in 2019. But we're using this occasion just to highlight the lack of economic security that is experienced by Black women in Florida. And this is from a report called Working Black Women in Florida and Economic Insecurity, A Story of Gender and Racial Inequality by Mary Gatta and Jessica Horning. It was commissioned by AAUW of Florida with several of our branches. And I think the main thing that I've learned about it is let's say 66% of all Black women and half of Black full-time working women do not earn enough to reach economic security for their family type. And what do we mean by economic security? I could go on and on about that, but it's not the federal poverty level. There's a special index called the BEST index. It is a realistic index that's based on family type and allows for enough savings to get by. It does not allow for luxurious living or going to the movies, but it's a better benchmark than the federal poverty level. So we've taken a look at that, and the researchers have also taken a look at some of the issues that might help to explain this problem, and those include occupational segregation, which simply means that they noticed that Black women are concentrated in certain occupations that have low wages and no benefits.
Right. Tamika Jackson, let's talk about what that means here in Jacksonville as we struggle through this pandemic and recession. You look at these numbers in your role as a committee chair for the Mayor's Commission on the Status of Women. In a state where black women make 60 cents for every white man's dollar and the occupational segregation that Pat mentioned, how do you see these dynamics playing out here on the ground in Northeast Florida?
Honestly, I will say it is very accurate. Myself, I'm not from Florida. However, I will consider myself to be very educated. But when I look at my counterparts, other black women, we have been placed in positions of either where we cannot be in management positions, or they consider, for whatever reason, lack of education or a lack of experience, we are kept in certain positions where it's less than what the majority of our counterparts are making. And when it comes to us trying to secure ourselves in upper level management, we're halted for several different reasons. So when I see the fact of the 60 cent per dollar that a Caucasian or white man makes, it's very accurate. I have several degrees, including graduate degree, and even I still make less than my white counterparts doing the same exact job or doing more. And I have seen that over and over again in the past 9 years that I've been living in the state of Florida.
So, Pat, black women are in dire economic straits in this state, in particularly black single mother-headed households. 90% of these women, as you said, fall below the line, even if they're employed. And they are employed right now in often in occupations that require them to come into contact with the public who might not always be wearing masks. So not only are they often essential workers who are receiving lower pay, they are more at risk of contracting COVID-19 right now, too, due to the occupational segregation that you mentioned. Yes?
Oh, that's very true. And also, if they are not getting health care benefits at work, which most of these low-paying occupations don't have health insurance. We are dependent on employers in this country for providing health insurance, which leaves a lot of people out. First of all, if you're part-time, you're not going to get any benefits. Even if you're full-time in these low-paying occupations, you probably won't have that, and that leads to the health gap. It leads to lots of things. If you are not getting proper health care, you're going to miss work because you don't have any sick leave at work either. So then you'll be seen as an unreliable employee. This is one of the main drivers of the inequality of wages for women.
Right. So Tamika, tell us a little bit about your work as an advocacy chair for the Mayor's Commission on the Status of Women to bring these issues to light and to help address their longstanding inequities.
Well, what we currently do, we go to different organizations and communities to have focus groups to discuss the challenges that women are having within their workplace, their work environment, access to health care, benefits, and different resources. And what we found across the board is either having a lack of education, or even if they did have access to health care, not being able to actually take time off because they were the breadwinners in the home, so they couldn't actually take the time off because they can't afford to be sick. So we have gone out there and found out what the community needs from us and have been bringing attention during either we've been having monthly meetings, we've been having speaker engagements, we've been having relationships with community partners to bring all this information together, to bring back to the mayor and the council members so that we can change the current dynamics. So we're going to continue to advocate for that because there has to be a change in how things are currently operating when it comes to accessing health care, accessing benefits, but also being able to take that time off to take care of themselves because they are the breadwinners of the household.
Right. And Pat, how is AAUW, beyond issuing reports and studies like this, how are they advocating in this space too?
One thing that we do to combat occupational segregation is we have an emphasis on STEM careers, which is science, engineering,
science, technology, engineering, math.
Technology, engineering, and math. Those are not all the high-paying occupations, but they are ones in which women are poorly represented, and minority women very poorly represented. We have a state camp. We were unable to run that this year because of the coronavirus, but we will be running it next year for middle school girls. The Jacksonville AAUW branch helps to sponsor Expanding Your Horizons, which is a one-day workshop for the same age middle school women to let them know a little bit about these careers. I'd like to see us move into other areas of inspiring young women to think of other types of careers that they might go into besides besides these low-paying careers. Now, what's going to happen to our needs for home health aides and like that? But we're still going to need them. So the other thing that AAUW does is we advocate for legislative changes. And one thing we're going to definitely be working on this year is to raise the minimum wage. Let me just mention a couple of little figures. According to the BEST index that I talked about, which I could go into detail, but I'm not, we don't have time. If you have one worker and two kids, you need $60,420 a year. Now, that's way more than you can make in this, these things. In Jacksonville, these BEST indexes can be localized. In Jacksonville, for that family, you need $62,508 a year. If you have two workers and two kids, you need in Jacksonville $73,212.
And when you say that number, you mean to pay for housing, food, and all the other monthly bills.
Well, there's an incredibly long list, which includes emergency savings, retirement savings, and children's higher education and homeownership, but
okay.
Not big allowances on those.
Yeah, way, in other words, way above minimum wage. Well, on this Black Women's Equal Pay Day, I want to thank you both for highlighting these issues. Pat DeWitt, Chair of AAUW Florida, that's American Association of University Women, and Damika Jackson, she's Committee Chair of Advocacy and Education on the Mayor's Commission on the Status of Women here in Jacksonville. Ladies, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having us.
Well, nowadays we get really excited to hear about a local business opening in this recession and pandemic. And Sunday Gathering Table, which just opened in St. Augustine, is one of these things we're excited about because they combine two of our favorite things, food and art. Yeah, chef and co-owner Edwin Baltzley is on the line. Hey, Edwin, good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. And kudos to you. You responded to this pandemic first off by baking bread, which millions of Americans have been doing. And from the sourdough you baked came St. Augustine's newest restaurant. Tell me about the Sunday Gathering Table.
So we started to develop a concept similar to what we have now, without baking fresh bread daily. And the pandemic kind of gave way to allowing me to, having ample time to start baking bread at the house. And so I was never really good at bread before in the past. I was always kind of intimidated by it. So I had all the time in the world to kind of tackle that. And after a lot of practice, we just decided to implement that as part of.
And I think we might have lost you there. If you're still with us, this restaurant is open for breakfast, lunch, late night eats, drink specials. And not only is the food amazing, there's an art component too. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. We share the space with Jenna Allen in our studio. And she is a wonderful local artist and a good friend of ours that does just really amazing things. And we have her studios inside the building as well. So you can see all the action happening on her side of stuff while you're eating.
What's the response been from the public?
I think it's been pretty good. St. Augustine has responded well. I mean, we've had a lot of people coming out in the community. A lot of people we've known from our other business, and they've kind of rallied behind us and supported us as safely as possible. We're doing the best we can to allow, you know, a proper circulation of people through there without having too many at a time, without having, you know, things be unsafe or unsanitary. But it's been great.
And even in the midst of this time we're living through, people just still want to gather. They want to do it safely. Were you nervous at all about opening up a business in this tough time, or how are you feeling about that?
Oh, yeah, we were totally nervous. In fact, we stalled it out two times before we actually opened for a week each time. My wife got tested like two times in 14 days through that, and we all got tested before we finally opened the doors to the public. So it was like, we were a little nervous, we were a little apprehensive, but the last thing we wanted to do was, you know, open up and then cause major problems in the community with an outbreak or something. So, yeah.
And again, getting back to the bread, in crisis, people turn to something comforting. And for some reason, bread is that thing. And your sourdough bread and your other menu items are winning raves. What do you think it is about this particular food that is so comforting to people?
I think maybe it's the whole like breaking bread concept that like goes like in its literal form when you're sharing these fresh breads at a table together. That's one thing I think, and as well as like brunch, people love to kind of congregate and gather for brunch too. Like that's a stop in and out thing, and it's cool to have fresh bread available while you're having brunch, I think.
Sure. Well, Sunday Gathering Table is open. Great food and great art with a working studio. So go check it out. They are located at 73 San Marco Avenue in St. Augustine, open every day, 8:30 to 4. And some late night bites on Fridays and Saturdays. Chef and co-owner Edwin Baltzley with us. And congratulations. We'll see you at the restaurant. Thanks so much for being with us.
All right. Thanks, Melissa. I'm a big fan.
Thank you so much. And whatever neighborhood you happen to be in, keep supporting the locally owned independent restaurant community because they need your support right now. Speaking of support, in a moment, we'll tell you why blood banks in this area need your help. A special opportunity to donate today. Not just blood, but also plasma for some of you. We'll explain in just a moment here on First Coast Connect. Don't go away.
Hungary and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congaryandpenn.com for more information.
UF Health Jacksonville, celebrating 150 years of caring for our community. Founded in 1870, UF Health Jacksonville is a major academic health center serving Northeast Florida and Southeast Georgia. Learn more at ufhealthjacks.org. This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Max Mayfield, former director of the National Hurricane Center. This hurricane season, you need to update your family preparedness plan so it includes COVID-19 preparations. So when a storm threatens, be ready to prepare your home and have your family hurricane kit ready. Include supplies for your pets and enough COVID-19 sanitizers, disinfectant wipes, and masks. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorm.org.
When back to school doesn't mean back in school, parents feel the squeeze.
We're trying to help our kid. We're trying to do our job that we're getting paid for.
Lots of rounds of tears.
How is it going to affect our children, you know, long term? It's terrifying.
There just aren't enough hours in the day to do all of it.
Bracing for more distance learning. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Virginia is the first state to launch an app that automatically tells you if you've been exposed to the coronavirus. It's been created by Apple and Google, but it needs a critical mass of users for it to stand a chance of working well. Is Virginia and the rest of America ready to go there? I'm Jen White. That story next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, even in a pandemic, actually, especially in a pandemic, blood banks need you to donate. And they especially need the plasma of patients on the mend from COVID-19. You can do your part at a blood drive happening in multiple locations across this community today. I learned more from Karen Patterson, Community Development Coordinator for LifeSouth. Take a listen. Karen, good to talk to you.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. Very nice to speak with you as well.
I'm glad to get this information on because you're seeing a huge increase in demand for not just blood, but also convalescent plasma from recovered COVID-19 patients, correct?
That's correct. LifeSouth has actually seen a 500% increase in demand for convalescent plasma.
Wow. Because the plasma from a recovered COVID patient, it really is an amazing treatment option for someone who's sick. How does the plasma help those who are struggling with the disease?
Well, the plasma that people donate when they've recovered from COVID-19 is very rich in antibodies that can be used to help those that might not have the strongest immune system or they might have some underlying health conditions. So it's really a good boost to that person's immune system to fight off the disease of COVID-19.
All right. So you really are asking, putting the call out for the community, if you are a recovered COVID patient, to come and donate plasma, but you also need everyday blood donors too, yes?
That's correct. Due to the current situation with COVID-19, our blood drive schedule is a lot lighter than we typically expect for this time of year. Schools and colleges are closed, and a lot of drives are holding off on booking drives until maybe the first of the year, or it depends on how the reopening goes.
So you need people to take the time. Local hospitals are depending on the community. How are you ensuring everything remains sanitary and there's no virus transmission when people come to donate blood?
We have implemented a CDC guideline to where we sanitize everything that touches a patient. We will take someone's temperature before they get on the blood mobile, and we have signs encouraging people, if you think you might be having some symptoms, you know, now is not a good time, please consult with your physician. Everyone wears masks on the blood mobiles, and we've limited the number of people to comply with social distancing guidelines.
All right, so it's LifeSouth.org, or just go on out to their donor centers in the community. There's one at 7840 Bay Meadows Way, one at Baptist Medical Center on Prudential Drive, and look for the blood mobile today at Memorial Hospital until 5 o'clock. Come on out and donate blood, especially if you're type O, but they want all eligible blood donors. And if you can donate convalescent plasma, if you are a recovered COVID-19 patient, they really need that too. Karen Patterson, Community Development Coordinator for LifeSouth, thank you so much for spreading the word. And everybody, get out and donate. Thanks so much, Karen.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a great day.
And again, there's multiple locations for that blood drive today. Check out Baptist Medical Center, Memorial Hospital. They'll have the blood mobile out today. And then also down on Bay Meadows Way. All over this community today are opportunities for you to donate blood or, again, as she said, plasma. If you are a recovering COVID-19 patient, if you are in that category, your plasma is extremely valuable to other patients who are battling coronavirus. It has made a huge difference in their recoveries. So, you know, consider doing this today. It's safe. It only takes a few minutes. And remember, they really need you more than ever now because in this pandemic, donations are way down. So get out there if you can and do your part. More at their website, which is livesouth.com or livesouth.org. And that is our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. If you missed anything from today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, or our podcast will be up later today wherever you download your favorite podcasts. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Have a great day. Stay safe out there. Go donate blood, and please make sure to keep wearing your masks. We'll be back here again and connect with you at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.